Hi, I'm Brandon Poe, founder of Poe Group Advisors and creator of the Accounting Practice Academy. You are listening to the Accountant's Flight Plan podcast, where we talk about stuff in the accounting world. If you're looking to buy or sell a practice, we are the premier accounting practice intermediary firm in the industry. Check us out at poegroupadvisors.com. If you're a firm owner looking to build a more profitable practice while actually reducing owner hours, sign up for our practice management workshop, which only runs a few times per year. Learn more at accountingpracticeacademy.com. Welcome to the Accountant's Flight Plan podcast. I have a really special guest today, Daryl Boyd. And what we decided to do on the podcast is something a little different than we've done before. And we're going to have our own team members on as guests. And so Daryl is, we've had a couple of team members on in the past, but we're going to do a whole series of these and release them throughout 2024. A little bit about Daryl. So he joined Poe Group Advisors in 2016, and he serves clients in Eastern Canada and the Northeastern U.S. He's a firm believer in prioritizing the people side of accounting firm acquisitions and strives to bring a personal rather than simply transactional approach to the industry. Before joining our group, he was a project manager in the engineering industry, which he thinks is surprisingly similar to the accounting industry, which maybe we'll expand on that a little bit. And when he's not brokering practices, you can find him coaching an accountant on how to run the kind of accounting firm that a business owner really needs. So I like that. Welcome, Daryl.
Oh, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's I think it's an interesting story too, just how we got connected from across the border.
Yeah, for sure. So
I went into the Toronto market, I think it was like 2006. Mm-hmm. And we were introduced by an accountant that we both knew and in Toronto. And I asked him, I said, do you know anybody entrepreneurial? I really want to get someone on the ground in Toronto to kind of help us expand. Mm-hmm. And he said, let me think about that. Yeah. And he said, yeah, I think I do. I know this guy. And then we got connected. And that's sort of my side of things from the early on, and love to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, it was an interesting time. I was doing project management at the time, as you had said, for an engineering firm. And my wife was actually moving out of teaching and starting her own business. And so as she was doing that, once it was settled and everything was working well, I said, hey, I'm thinking of doing something new. And so we talked about it. And so I talked to my accountant and I said, hey, looking at maybe buying a business, getting involved in something just different. And he said, well, interesting that you mentioned that, because, and he just mentioned this connection with Brandon. And so he gave me the, I remember writing down the number. As a matter of fact, I just found it the other day. I have got this little this sticky note with Brandon's phone number on it. But so I gave Brandon a call. And I immediately liked him, as most people do. We had a good conversation. And so I talked to Lisa, my wife, and I said, okay, look, this is kind of intriguing. At first, it was sort of interesting because she said, well, accounting firms, like, isn't that kind of boring? And I said, well, I don't think so. It doesn't sound like it would be. So we, anyway, I said, look, if this is going to be anything, I got to go down and meet him. So of course, as Brandon said, I'm in Toronto, Ontario. So flew down to Charleston, had a great time meeting Brandon and his family, just talking about this, looking at the possibilities. I think I'd say what hit me the most, because I remember passing through DC on the way back, and I called Lisa and I said, what hit me the most about the trip was that what Brandon was doing for accountants aligned really well with how I'm wired, my core values, as it were. And that was really significant. I just saw it as being an amazing possibility. So when I got back, Brandon and I talked some more, had more conversations about what things could look like. And that's how things got started.
Yeah, it was, I knew you had a lot of integrity. You had a lot of questions. You took in the information very quickly. And, which kind of is going to bring me to my next question, because I It may not have been the easiest deal, but I remember the first deal you had was it just kind of clicked really well. And I think I remember saying, yeah, they might not all work out this easily, Daryl. Like, I just want you to know.
That's true. Yeah, I remember that. It's funny too how these things kind of tie in because when we had, I remember when we were walking, and excuse me, I often remember things because of where I am or a place or something. And we were walking in Charleston, which, of course, if any of you haven't been there, it's beautiful to go and visit. Great city to walk. And so we were walking, and you were talking to me about sellers, and we don't push people to sell. Like, this is a pretty big deal. For many accountants, this is their whole life's work. And so to be able to stop doing that and turn it over to somebody else, it's a pretty big deal. And that resonated with me. And so when I was looking at the first deal I had, had a good conversation. There were two partners. They were excited about the possibility of moving on. And but then there was one who, it was an interesting conversation because I had Brandon in the back of my mind and I was thinking, okay, I want to be sure that they're good and ready. And so at the end of the conversation, it just seemed like that the one partner still thought, okay, this would be a good possibility. Yeah, I see that I could, because they were a little bit younger and they could just continue doing this. And so the other partner called a day or two later and said, well, Daryl, I think you lost a sale because you talked my partner out of selling. So I think it was maybe a month or two after that that we talked, and then the partner was back on. In other words, they tried what they were going to do, and then it really hit them and said, you know what? I just this isn't going to be for me. But it was interesting because I know I had worked kind of like what Brandon had said to for the best interest of my client to say, what do they really want? And I found that across the board that, yeah, with sellers, it's a pretty big deal. They have some thinking to do. But after that, it was really smooth sailing. Found a great buyer, and I felt like because we got that motivation out of the way right at the beginning, that the rest worked really well.
Yeah, when they know, it's different than just kind of going in and going, I think I know what I want to do, right? It's because what I would imagine might have happened if let's say you didn't give them that space to think through and really think through what they wanted, they might have gone ahead and tried to sell the practice, and then that would have hit at some point. It might have hit when they've got their first offer. It might have hit when they fought, talked to their first buyer, and then you would have paused. And then by then, you've got other people involved and so much time invested. And so I think the way you approached that was actually just, well, it worked out, but I think it was the right thing to do. Even if it had gone the other way, I think it was the right approach.
Well, yeah, I think so. These things I find they just have a way of coming back. It's as I said, and I'll probably say it a few times along the way here, I've really learned that it's a pretty big deal, and it takes a little bit in talking to somebody to really get a sense of motivation and a sense of, hey, this is a big step for them. Some are really, like in this case, they were really absolutely sure. Sometimes you have to start along the way and they're pretty sure, but not quite sure. And I understand that as well. I mean, some of it isn't so much that they're not sure, it's just they're uncertain. What's it going to look like? A buyer coming in and that kind of thing. But what I appreciate about this industry, and it has some overlaps with engineering as well, but the integrity of the sellers, like the reason why it kind of makes them nervous is because they care about their clients, they care about their staff, and they're not going to hand that over to just anybody. And all they've known up to that point that can control things is themselves. So,
Now, I was going to ask you, like, okay, what's an example of your easiest transaction that you've ever seen, and what's maybe the one of the toughest that you've seen? Is that one rank up there towards the top of?
that would be one of the easiest. We've had some that have been like that, but that one, it was pretty straightforward. It makes a big difference when you've got people, like I said, who are motivated. There was a lot of respect, buyer and seller back and forth. I had another one which is quite similar to that, just a little bit bigger in size, but a few years later. And that one really stands out to me because the seller, it's this seller was so like I got continual feedback from buyers saying, you know what? It was a good call. This might be a possibility, or other people saying, you know what, it wasn't a great fit, but what they all said was, that was amazing conversation. It was just really good. It was not a waste of time, even if they didn't go forward. that everybody had this sense of respect from the seller, that the seller was respecting the buyer's time and being interested in their firm. And that was a lot like that first one. So it went really smoothly. It
Yeah.
when the buyer really gets a sense that not only is the seller wanting to make sure there's a good fit, but they really care about who that buyer is going to be. That's why when you were talking about my bio, and I don't apologize for this relational aspect with what we do is it's yeah, there's a lot to it there that it's not just transactional kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you really get to it's sometimes I have clients and I'm kind of sad that the transaction is coming to a close because you develop a real friendship with them and you care about them on a deeper level and then the transaction's over and it's amazing how fast our role ends. I mean that it's like once the deal closes we can be there for support and transition assistance and those sorts of things, but usually they're pretty busy and they have to move on. And so you kind of
Right.
lose that relationship most of the time.
Yeah, but there's always that key thing that for that point in life where you were working together on something, and it was a pretty significant thing that each party had to do. So yeah, there's the kind of that tie-in that doesn't really go away. And
Yeah.
I don't know about your experience, but even just following up with sellers, there's always that little, we went through that together kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it
Yeah.
usually takes, I mean, but the thing is too, is like the seller is usually quite busy right after the closing,
For
you know,
sure. Oh yeah.
so they're preoccupied a little bit for a while. So it's fun to kind of go back 6 months after the close when everything's all the dust is settled and that's always enjoyable.
Yeah,
What about your
absolutely.
toughest deal?
Well, I'm going to describe it like some practices are easier to sell than others. So I'm not talking about so much the difficulty of actually finding a buyer and selling, but just the experience of it. I did have a seller once who had a really good firm. I got to give them that. It was just really good. But you know that what I was just talking about when I talked about a seller that really they have that respect for the buyer. They're putting themselves in the buyer's shoes and saying, "Look, I know somebody else has to take this over, and they're paying for this practice. They want to be able to keep the clients." I think this particular buyer, and it's awful to say this, I suppose, but I think they were so focused on the dollar, and they were so focused. And hey, we get really good value for our practices, but it was almost as if it was never quite enough kind of thing. And so remember I talked at the beginning about that relational thing. That was tricky when it came to be with buyers. Now, as it turned out, got a great buyer. This was a few years back. I talked to this buyer actually in the spring, and they're doing amazing because it was really a wonderful practice. But it's almost like the seller knew it was so good, so they were just focused on the practice and the money in their pocket. And it took a little bit of It took a lot. It didn't take a little bit. It took a lot of conversations to help them to be able to understand. By the end of the process, I will say that they certainly did a great job in helping with transition and all of that kind of thing. But that was a bit more of a struggle. It wasn't hard to find buyers. They were there, but it was almost the seller. And maybe for them, maybe that was their way of wrestling through this. Like I said, it's a
Yeah.
big deal to sell your firm. Maybe for them, that's the way it came out, and you never quite know. But and we talk a lot with, as you, of course, with sellers, and we have a lot of conversations. And so I don't know, you're wanting the seller to say, "Oh, can you just give a little bit here? Like you're getting an amazing price." And I should say they've gotten, well, it was quite an amazing price for their firm. So,
Yeah.
yeah, that one was a bit of a toughie.
Yeah, I remember that deal, and I remember talking with you about that one. I think I know exactly which one you're talking about. So,
And hey, like I said, the buyer's doing well, and I've even talked to the seller after that, and they're fine too. But maybe there's something about this significance of handing over something that's very close to one's day-to-day and their heart and everything, that it brings out something that maybe wasn't there before, and you kind of just got to work through it.
I do think motivation is really important because, like you said, if someone's not ready to move on to that next stage of life, because that's usually what happens when someone sells, is they're turning the page and they're entering a new stage of life, whether it be retirement, which is a big change, right? That's a big lifestyle change, or it's a whole new opportunity and there can be angst around that. Like, am I going to be successful in this new opportunity? Is this going to be what I thought it was? So those are hard things to really be fully committed to, because they're big changes.
And
So.
it's just so different from person to person. So you don't know how much you're going to get of, the one person that wonders, I'm sure you've had these conversations. You're talking to a seller and they're being very sincere when they're saying, I don't know what I'm going to do now. I don't know what my life is going to look like. And then there are others that just have, like the one that I mentioned to you that would had such good feedback from buyers. Their work was getting in the way of their life. Like they just had so many things to do after they retired, and they've, but it's just different. People are different.
It's absolutely. So what would you say to someone who's like contemplating a sale? Let's say they come to you and they want to get ready, whether it be ready with what they want to do next and like whatever their definition of getting ready is. Can you think of one or two pointers that you feel have helped people the most over the years?
Preparation is good when you have time for it. Sometimes you just, I it seems as sellers, you kind of just wake up one day and say, okay, I'm gonna sell, and they list and off we go. And we have a lot of those, and it works just fine. When you have an opportunity to plan ahead, then you can, it gives us the opportunity to talk about things that might be, like for example, there could be things that a seller might not think that a buyer would be concerned about at all. But then you start to get through the process and you realize that, oh, wait a second, here's something with a, the buyer might have a problem. Well, why would they have a problem with that? And you get into this discussion that had we had that discussion 2 years ago, could have put something in place to mitigate that. Something as simple, Brandon, as a email and a phone number. I mean, there are a lot of people that this, they're a sole practitioner. They kind of just get used to using their personal phone and their email. And so I've had many cases where they go to sell and the subject comes up, and sometimes it comes up late. You don't realize this, and they're talking to a buyer and they say, well, of course I want to keep my email that I have, which maybe is the business URL and phone number. And the buyer's saying, well, but that's part of the goodwill I'm buying here, is I want to be able to have the clients contact me. And you have this discussion here where a seller, honestly, they just didn't think of it. They knew they wanted it, but they're making an assumption about it. And so there are a host of those kinds of things that if you can talk about those beforehand, and I that will really help. I have some sellers that they sort of have a long-term plan. We talk once a year, sometimes even do a, just an update in the valuation once a year, and they're just ready. I mean, some of them, there's one I talk to every fall. I don't know if they've got a great practice. I don't know if there's anything they could really do to make things better. I know it'll be a really easy sale, because it's just so good, and they've taken away all the clutter. Anything that would get in the way of a deal, which sometimes is different. The things that get in the way of the deal are sometimes different than how you run the practice. Sometimes they're the same, but sometimes they're different. Sorry, that's a long answer to that
Yeah,
one.
no, I think it kind of falls into two categories, right? In my mind, as we're thinking through this, it's, getting ready for what's next in life, I think is important, because you need to be motivated to sell, or you're not going to sell.
For
I
sure,
think
yeah.
so. I think that's one part of it, is like planning what's next. And the clearer you can be about that, I think it serves you better. To be excited about what's next, not leaving something because you're not happy with the practice. I think if you're not happy with your practice, and I do find that a lot of practitioners fall into that category as they're approaching retirement, is they're kind of getting tired, they're getting worn down a little bit. And so there's a negative feeling towards the practice. And for those people, like, sometimes preparing can actually extend how long you want to stay in the business, right? If you can take those pain points away from the practice, then you actually might enjoy the practice and might want to stick around longer, which is fine with us, right? So, yeah, I think it's those two categories that
Yeah,
some
kind of
people.
preparing oneself kind of thing, as you said, and then preparing the practice. And there's a significant overlap because those things that moat, like in that example that I gave, obviously there's a moat motivation for the individual to keep their personal information, their contact info, but was it really that important? Like if they had planned ahead, they could still keep that same they could still keep their contact info, but just change it so it's not connected with the business. So I sat down once and I was thinking about these types of things as it relates to valuation. I know I've told you this before, but I remember the day I sat down and I thought, how many things affect valuation and saleability? And so I just did this little brain dump of all this stuff. And I stopped at around 160, there's 165, something like that, different points that affect these things. And then I categorize them together. And I add to the list now too, because things come up. And these are things that when you're brokering firms, you just know they're just in the back of your mind. They're just always there, but they're not always there with the buyer and they're not always there with the seller. So you gotta work through these assumptions. That word assumption comes up a lot. It comes up a lot of my thinking. Assumptions about a buyer, what they would have about how their practice could work, a seller assumptions about their own practice and its desirability. So I think a lot of what we do is just working through these things to expose those assumptions and say, are they correct or not? And if they're not, then what's reality like and how do we conform to, what's real in the marketplace kind of thing.
The market's kind of its own fickle little thing too. It's always changing, you know. Let's talk a little bit about transition because I feel like that's one of the things that we have as a company have really done a good job at focusing on, okay, how do we help the buyer seller transition? How do we help that handoff, and how do we help that buyer be really successful? So what do how do you set up buyers to just their own expectations? Like what do you tell them about transition? Do you feel like that really is crucial for people to understand going into a purchase?
Yeah, for sure. I said assumptions a second ago. Honestly, that's the biggest thing with transition, because transition to me is just about human behavior. How do people behave when they're told a particular type of news and what the next steps will be? And honestly, sometimes this is where engineering and accounting can be somewhat similar. Is in you've got professionals, they care about certain kinds of things, but because they're hyper-focused on doing the best that they can do and that they should do in the work that they're doing, whether it's financial statements they're doing or a design for a building or something like that. They do that really well, but they'll make certain assumptions about what their client wants. Now, sometimes it's very clear what the client wants, but if you've got an accounting firm, you've got lots of clients, they'll want different kinds of things. And some assumptions a seller makes, for example, would be, and sorry to say this to the sellers, but if a seller suddenly stops working, all of your clients aren't going to close their businesses. They're going to go somewhere else eventually. So you may be a really good accountant and you're really good at helping your clients, but you will be replaceable at the end of the day. But there's an assumption that no, if I just, and this is actually the way I ask sellers, because a seller will say, look, my clients, they're really dedicated to me. I don't see how another buyer could come in there. And I say, okay, well, let's just say you walk away from your practice. I assume then your clients will just all close up their businesses too. Oh, no, well, they're not going to do that. That's ridiculous. And I say, well, where are they going to go? Well, they're going to find another accountant. I said, yeah, but that you were not there to help them to, build into the buyer and to help them with the nuances of the, the clientele from years back. And they start to get this sense that, oh yeah, I work th through that assumption that the clients are just going to, that I'm the only person, but I can take that value that the clients have in me and I can build into the buyer. We can put together a plan. Same thing with a buyer. They'll assume that, okay, if we tell them that the client, the practice has been, is transitioning over to somebody else, that they're all going to head for the hills, but they don't. Like, honestly, I'm not a CPA. I'm a client. My wife and I both have businesses, and we rely very heavily on our client, or on our accountant. And I kind of expect them to be able to pass us over to somebody else when the time comes. And as long as another buyer aligns with that, then I'll say, okay, yeah, that's good. I've trusted my accountant this far. I'm going to trust their choice of a successor. Now, if the successor screws up, okay, yeah, but I just it's really a pain to find a new accountant. So to be able to stay with the one that you trust and the person that they trust to take it over, that works. So for me, just working through these assumptions.
If you own a CPA practice, you're no stranger to the grind. It's easy to get so buried in work that you lose sight of the bigger picture. Oftentimes, in order to improve, we need to change our point of view. Accounting Practice Academy by Poe Group Advisors gives you that fresh perspective, so you can achieve success on your terms. This virtual workshop gives you the tools and mindsets to grow your bottom line and make your firm less owner dependent. You'll use your firm's data to zoom out and see your challenges and opportunities with amazing clarity. Most APA members come to realize that pruning their clients and doing less will actually generate more income. Poe Group Advisors has sold hundreds of accounting practices. We know that the firms that are the easiest to operate are also the most valuable ones in the marketplace. APA is the only workshop built from that mergers and acquisitions perspective, which means our members build more valuable practices. Create a better practice for you and your employees to enjoy, or build it to sell. The choice is yours.
You're right. It's an interesting thing that happens when a practice turns over. I always explain to the accountants, like, look, you're dealing with these issues every day. You get up every day and you come to work on your practice. Your client comes in, you know, maybe they don't ever come in at all. Maybe it's all virtual. And they may interact with you monthly. They may interact with you twice a year, once a year. Like, that's a small part of their life. So they're not devastated when they hear that you sell. They may be a little surprised. They may be a little, maybe even a little disappointed because you're leaving and they had that trust, and but they're not devastated. So
yeah, that's what I found. And but it's that's not the immediate thought that sellers usually have. So it's, you know, it's kind of working through that a little bit.
Which is kind of good that they feel that way, right? That they care. That's the thing. I think accountants care.
Do you know what I think is cool though for the buyer continuing on is if you can get a seller to kind of open up with their assumptions about their clientele, and you can get the buyer to do the same, then they're looking at this and they're saying, okay, well, what is true about these clients, and what do they really need? If they don't just need this accountant, but what do they need? They need somebody to do the year end for their business. They need actually a whole lot of other things. And I think that leads in a business development direction, where on the buyer side, if I can have a buyer, like if I were to have a discussion with the buyer, I'd say you spend that first year learning what your clients really need, because it's not always what the accountant thinks. This is where I think it's interesting accounting going forward, because people are concerned with, you know, AI and automation and all of these kinds of things. But I firmly believe, as a business owner, and usually I'm telling buyers and sellers, look, I'm the one who's not an accountant here. I'm thinking like a client. So you got to listen to me, because I'm telling you what I need. I think it would be hard. I maybe know two accountants in probably in the GTA right now, Greater Toronto Area, who I would say they're doing everything that their clients would need for, like, because of how things are changing in business in years to come. Most of the others are focused on compliance. This is what we did before. We're looking back. We're doing the work. We're doing the year end. But they're not having those conversations with their clients to say, what do you really need? They'll make an assumption about it. And I think when you really can, I don't know. I reflect on this myself, because like time savings, for example, I mean, I'm busy from day to day with things. If my accountant can help me understand something that's going to save me time, I'm happy to pay for that. And I think there are clients that are happy to pay for more. It's the accountant that's the problem. They're not realizing that, well, you know, and it's not just services. There are different kinds of things, and each client's going to be a little different.
Yeah. And going back to assumptions with that, like, I've been around enough business owners where they sort of are assuming their accountant should be looking after certain things in their business and should be bringing certain things to their attention, and it's not happening. And then they get frustrated. And, you know, I've had conversations with business owners, and like, well, your accountant is a tax person, and you probably, if you want these kinds of services, unfortunately, it's not likely going to be offered to you where you are. You're going to have to go and find someone that's going to offer that sort of service and understands what your needs are. I think sometimes the sellers can have assumptions about their clients that are just totally wrong. And a buyer can come in and make a lot of improvements in the practice because that buyer is not going to operate under those assumptions. For example, pricing is a great example. I've had conversations with a lot of sellers that say, "Oh, I can't possibly increase my prices. People will leave." And then I'll have a buyer come in, and one of the first things they do is increase some of the pricing, and they have no problem at all. But they're also changing some of the offerings. And we had one buyer who basically created a packaged pricing offering and grew the practice like two or three times in the first year. I mean, it was just amazing growth because they just repackaged things and repackaged the offerings. But I agree with you. There aren't a lot of firms out there doing that.
Yeah, listen to your clients, listen to the industry. But yeah, it takes some doing. I'm smiling because I'm thinking I've talked a few times about engineering and accounting. When I was working for a particular engineering firm, we had a client that we did a lot, most of the work that I did for them, and they wanted something from us. And I won't go into details of what it was, but it was a major project. It was an ongoing project. It would have been, in my view, pretty easy for us to take on, but it wasn't engineering. It had to do with some other thing. So I won't go into all of that, what it is, but I'm sitting there with the client, and this is a big client. I mean, everybody would know who this is. And I've got the team here, and the client's practically begging us to do this for them. And I see it as, this is business-wise a great opportunity. This is kind of like easy money, and we'd really be helping the client. And I'm talking to the engineers after, and that was their biggest stumbling point, was, this isn't engineering. We can't process this. Well, who cares if it's, does it align with engineering? Oh yeah, it aligns really well. I can see how, because of the work that we do, aligns great, but it's not engineering. And so we never ended up doing the work because it didn't fit into the mold of how we did projects. You know, we do civil design, we do this and this. And I'm sitting there thinking, how often does this happen? I mean, does this happen in other businesses? I'm pretty sure it happens in accounting, that there could be those key clients there who are really begging their accountant to do certain kinds of things for them, and the accountant's just used to doing what they do. I mean, it sounds very pointed that way, but I was sitting there kind of just dumbfounded that we weren't going in this particular direction business-wise with the engineers. And I have a whole list of these kinds of things for accountants. I've had a few conversations this year following up with buyers who've bought in the past, or just people that want to grow, and they're changing their businesses. Like, they're really starting to listen to their clients. They're doing all the accounting work. But see, I just think, sorry, I get kind of excited about this, but there are a few professions where you can have that trusted advisor at the core, you know, where you've got like any, I always think of going to my accountant first for anything, for referrals, for all kinds of that. Like, where do you have that in life where it's okay, the trusted person is that person, that's where we go. And to, so as buyers or just ongoing firm owners, thinking about that network that you have. If you don't do the work yourself, find somebody else that can help with that. Just every referral that Lisa and I have gotten for our life, really, I think almost any, all of them have come through our accountant. And you take it further than that. Anyway, you can see I get really interested in this. And if anybody wants, we can have a call on that sometime. But it's very exciting. And I think it can be exciting for a firm owner where you don't have to be afraid about these automation things and AI and that, as I said, you're focusing on the client. You'll discover some new revenue lines there, I think.
And I like what you're saying, that you've been referred to people. So that's an important thing to consider as well, is just because a client needs a certain service, it doesn't mean you have to develop that service, around one client. Like, for instance, if one client needs a business valuation, it doesn't mean you have to learn how to do business valuation and do it. But you can find somebody in the community that could do a good job for that. And then a lot of your clients might need a business valuation over time. And then you've got that referral partner. And I agree with you, and I've had that experience firsthand too. I mean, I'm a CPA. I could easily do my own books, and do my own accounting work, but I've hired someone to do that, and I get tremendous value from that because they have all those connections and relationships. And so when I need another resource, he points them out to me. It's awesome.
And it can be a powerful business engine when you have different components, different providers working together. Because honestly, I will be happy to pay a little bit more to have whoever's going to take the lead, whether it's the accountant contacting an investment advisor, an insurance advisor, business insurance, life insurance, there are all kinds of
Yeah.
things. Even other things that come in that are a little bit different that you might not have thought of that are related to accounting, like security, for example. I know big companies in, I can think of one in the States actually right now, that that's an essential component of what they do. They're not just gonna, they're not just doing the year end for their client. They're helping their client understand, well, you don't want to lose the money in these kinds of things that you've made. Security is a big deal.
Yeah.
So maybe they're not doing that, but they've got a contact for it. And so the convenience of having the accountant, or even like a client relationship manager, maybe not the accountant themselves, but somebody that contacts all of these people to take care of getting, like at tax time, for example, you got to get all these slips and all the stuff together. The coordination, there's a firm that it was a technically a personal tax firm. And they, we didn't end up selling them. They sold to a colleague. We were kind of talking about it. I was very impressed by what they were doing, but they had somebody else that was kind of close by. They were able to do their own sale, which was fine. But I said, well, what do you charge for a T1 personal tax return? They said, well, average is probably about 5 to 8,000. 5 to 8,000 for a personal tax return. What are you doing? Well, we don't really do that much personal tax. We're sort of like the financial center for these families. Okay, well, tell me more about it. And they've kind of latched on to this thing I'm talking about, where the tax return, that was just a tiny little part of what they did. What they did was they gave a family a place to go to basically kind of take care of anything to do with finances. And because they were trusted as the accountant, the family was happy to pay them a sizable sum to just take that off their plate.
Yeah.
It was kind of interesting to see how it played out, but I'd like to see more firms doing that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a seller that sold his traditional practice to go into that sort of family practice. 'Cause he had a couple of clients where he was doing that and he decided just to do that entirely. So, there's a lot of things you can do with an accounting practice. And that's one of the things that we sort of have a privilege of is we get to see all these different business models for how firms are operated. It's really shocking how much difference there is in margins, how much difference there is in pricing, and just the whole models have, there's a lot of variation in the marketplace.
And I'd say that for somebody who's kind of struggling with where they are, because it happens, as you know, they might want to explore some of these things. Like you just mentioned about that individual, they changed what they're presumably they sold that one practice type that they had, and they went in another direction of, more specifically for, families or large accounts that way. Different things for different people. So maybe the thing that you're struggling with as an accountant, because I talk to people like this, they don't like doing this particular thing, and you give them a bit of a vision for something different, and oh yeah, that would work.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's lots of different ways of being an accountant, I think,
Yeah,
these
for
days.
sure. Well, tell us a story. Do you have a funny story? Like one of the like something that's just sort of a little off the wall that people would find entertaining or interesting?
Oh dear, I'm not very good at being funny, Brandon. You know me. Well, I can. Well, this isn't entertaining, but it was a struggle. It was so I had a listing a few years back, and it was as it's a little more difficult to sell a listing in this tiny town, a small area. So I had a listing come up, but it came up, but it was a really good practice, and I thought, okay, let's just see what we can do. And then about a month later, I think this one was already listed. And there, I mean, I thought, well, there are only two accounting firms in this town. We'll see how it goes. Well, sure enough, doesn't the other one call and wants to list? So now I've got two firms listed in one town. And but the thing for me though was, I mean, confidentiality is a pretty big deal through all of this. So you got to switch your mind all the time to think, who am I talking about here? Because there are so many similarities. Oh, and then of course, well, who's going to buy this firm? Two different buyers? Well, it makes sense if you get a buyer for one of them, they're going to want to buy both of them, which is exactly what happened. So you've got one buyer and they're dealing with two different firms. And man, I tell you, I was just every time you get on some sort of a Zoom call, especially when the buyer and the seller are talking together, to keep all this stuff straight. I mean, it was a bit of a challenge. So fortunately, nothing happened, but those kind of things, it was oh boy, a lot to keep straight when you just thought, what are the chances of having that happen in one little town? So yeah.
I would have liked to have been a fly on the wall when each one of those sellers realized that the other, practice, because probably not very many firms in that little town,
No, there's just the two. And they closed
just the
within a
two.
week of each other. And we were trying to think, okay, well, how's this going to work? Because you can't have them close too far apart because they're going to, word's going to get, you know how small towns work, word's going to get out. So you always have to close them both at the exact same time, which is pretty much what happened. They closed within a week of each other. And anyway, it was interesting. Yeah, but that was a bit of a challenge.
I bet it was interesting for them to realize that that had happened and that
Yes. Yeah.
the same
Oh, and
buyer
the one
bought.
owner had worked for the other firm before years back. So, yeah, you've got all of these things. So, I guess those, you know how you said that a seller has to do a lot of work right after closing, especially so in this case, because you couldn't, time can just allow people to worry, think about all of this stuff. So, the seller had to be on, and they had somebody else helping them. They had to be on this right away to just keep, you know, have those meetings, make sure you're talking to the clients. So, they had a few different kinds of things to do all at once. That was interesting for sure.
Well, this has been a great conversation, and we could, talk for a long time about transition. I think we scratched the surface. We sort of talked about some high-level concepts with transition, but we do have a pretty detailed process that we take people through to help them understand their opportunities and understand their possible obstacles to transitioning well. And that's a fun, I think, challenging part of our work that both of us enjoy very much. But
Yeah, for sure.
yeah, I know you're not a huge reader, but any books over the years that you could maybe just suggest to people?
I actually am a huge reader. It's just the last few months I find I've had so many other things on my plate, so reading has set aside. Okay, this will be surprising, but I will tell you one book that has had it surprisingly has really helped me with when offers come in and when buyers and sellers see things different ways. So I won't go tell the whole story because it's long, but some of you might be familiar with J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote Lord of the Rings. He also wrote a book called The Silmarillion, and there are parts of it that, what's it called? Prime? Amazon Prime? Whatever, the Prime Video thing that they had done, what's it called? Rings of Power, I think. And they had components of it in there. Frankly, I haven't seen it yet. But Silmarillion, I first tried to read it when I was, oh, I don't know, I was in grade 6 or 7, and it was just too complex at the time. But I came back to it years later, and what I found is interesting is that it's kind of the whole story before the Lord of the Rings. So it goes back, and there are big histories there, big characters, you know, really interesting. But there's this struggle that's going on, and I won't go into the whole thing with you. But what I just found, and it really struck me one day, and it comes up whenever these offers come up, is that because you're seeing this whole other world there and you see the struggles that are happening, a lot of, you know, we talked about assumptions a little bit ago. In the book, it's more direct evil that's happening, but you find yourself thinking, if you just like, why are you listening to this? If you just ask, or if you just listen. So these things happen in the story that, in a sense, they shouldn't have happened, really, if the parties were kind of trusting each other. But when suspicions and those kinds of things come up, relationships go down, and it's disastrous. So looking at that story, I'm surprised how often it comes up, because when you get a buyer and a seller, like if there's one thing I could tell a buyer and a seller when they're in the midst of presenting offers, they're looking at this stuff, if anything comes up that seems odd, don't make assumptions about it. So often you'll talk to a seller and something will be in an agreement, and they'll say, oh, this is the buyer's trying to do this, this, or this, or this, something will come up and it comes back from a lawyer. on the buyer side, or, you know, and they'll make an assumption, the buyer will say, oh, the seller's trying to do something. I've just found that usually if you can get the parties to talk about it, it kind of just comes out. So people, if they're not talking, they make assumptions and then bad things happen. So that's what I learned from the Silmarillion that I turn into this all the time. So I, and my team's used to me saying this, something comes up, try to help you get on the phone and say, Dewey, you're assuming something or you're suspicious about something. Why is a buyer or seller doing this? Have you asked them? Let's talk about it. Let's kind of figure it out. Usually it's nothing. It honestly is. But yeah. I probably know there are things that throw deals just because you have two parties that aren't correctly speaking to each other, especially yeah. when things come back from the lawyer, because the lawyer is doing their job. They're putting together a legal agreement with words, but words aren't relational kind of things. You know, and sometimes you have to talk about it a bit to get the words right. So when you see something in black and white, oh, they're asking for this. Well, what do you mean? So the first thing should be, don't panic. Let's talk.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's a long story, but I'm surprised how often that that I remember these scenes from the Silmarillion when I'm talking with people.
Buyers no, that's a great recommendation. That's I always like these book recommendations. They're a little different, you know. They're I read a lot of business books because I enjoy them, but it's interesting how books like that can definitely impact all sorts of things. So thanks for sharing.
Yeah, because it forces you to come out of your world and go into another world for a bit, and you just see things differently with a novel. Yeah. So yeah.
Wow. Mm. Well, we will close off on that note. Daryl, what's the best way for people to follow you on the online or get in touch with you?
Well, I really enjoy having these kinds of conversations that we were talking about, helping people to be successful in their business as an accountant, to think a little bit differently. So those types of things is usually a phone call. So if you call our 800 number, what is it? 888-642-2693 is, and then I'm extension 800. Or you can send me an email at dboyd@pullgroupadvisors.com and we can connect, talk about some of these things for sure.
Awesome. Daryl, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to chat with you in this format. It's been fun.
Yeah. Great to talk to you too. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Accountant's Flight Plan Podcast. If you like what you heard today, please follow us so that you can get updates when new episodes are released, and share our podcast with your friends and colleagues. You can also follow Poe Group Advisors on social media. Please visit our website for more information at poegroupadvisors.com.